This is some work that we've done applying machine learning to the idea of entanglement, especially applied to squid qubits. Actually, there's two or three parts to this talk. The squid qubit part, the idea is that we want to initialize a set of squid qubits in an entangled state and have it calculate its own entanglement or calculate a witness to the entanglement. And then applying that to a quantum annealing machine, what we wanted to do is extend the capabilities possibly of a quantum annealer to more than just the annealing solutions. Can we make a quantum annealing machine anneal to an entangled state? More generally, what I'm showing you is kind of our approach to applying machine learning to quantum computers in the sense that we're not programming the quantum computer, we're going to have it learn itself to do the tasks that we're asking it to do. I guess kind of motivational from our standpoint is that what we want to do is, and most people want to do, is create computing hardware. From the standpoint of that pretty much any physical system that has sufficient computational complexity and adjustable parameters can be made to process inputs and calculate outputs. And the adjustable parameters then are the program. So I've just thrown up some examples here, like fluid flow in pipes could be a computer, although it would be really slow. Ants have shown to be solving minimum path problems. Mechanical devices for years have done computing. Obviously, the biological nervous system is the holy grail for a lot of people for computing. Electron flow in resistors, capacitors, and inductors created the analog computer a long time ago, even before I was born. And then Hopfield created an associative network where he built resistors and capacitors to do calculations. And of course, our current microprocessors use transistors to do the same thing. So where we are today is trying to do quantum computing. So the hardware that I'm obviously talking about is quantum computers. It seems over the last 20, 30 years that large-scale implementations always seem 10 years away. For various reasons, the microprocessor capability just keeps increasing and everybody uses that. Our focus is on the algorithm construction. It seems like there are some specific algorithms that work well, but how do you make a general purpose quantum computer do what you want? How do you scale it up from a few qubits? How do you deal with noise and decoherence? So the approaches that we've seen over the years are decomposition into quantum gates, which shows promise, but the scale up there could be issues. Quantum bits are promising, and then more recently, quantum annealing machines have made a great stride toward building bigger machines. What we're talking about here, what I'm going to show you, is our approach to machine learning, which is the point of this workshop. How do you use machine learning to overcome some of these issues with quantum computers? So here's kind of our contributions over the years to applying machine learning to the idea of a quantum computer. Of course, learning allows us to choose the adjustable parameters rather than programming it from examples. So we use supervised learning to get the correct input-output map from our quantum hardware. In the late 90s, early 2000s, we looked at quantum dots and showed that we could learn two input, one output classical and quantum logic gates. It was a very simple building block, but it was important to show that we could do that. We moved on to squids because we collaborated with Siwan Han at KU, who was doing squid hardware, and we hoped to implement that on that, his hardware. We were able to learn two and three qubit gates using machine learning and supervised learning. And then we moved on to learning an entanglement witness for squids for 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 qubits with the idea that, again, it would be an entanglement witness of its own entanglement. And then we learned and corrected phase shifts related to the squid computing as well. What I'm going to show you today are the bottom three in the green. The learning entanglement, the learning worked well and we could witness the entanglement, and so we wanted to show that it was robust to noise and decoherence. So we deliberately introduced noise and decoherence into the learning process. And then Elizabeth Behrman, my collaborator, said, well, let's see if we can make the D-wave system anneal to an entangled state. And we'll talk more about that. So we've done that. And then, I don't know, kind of a fantasy idea that I have is to create a spatial quantum computer using some kind of quantum continuum. And one of the things that we looked at was a quantum lattice gas. The interesting thing there that it has is it has soliton pathway behavior. If you create the signals going through it properly, it will actually create pathways in the material. And the thought is, well, could you create neural pathways that way? So that's kind of the dream, I guess, down the road. So learning the entanglement indicator, a real quick overview of that, just a few slides to show you what we did there. We used the density matrix formulation with the Schrodinger equation. And the Hamiltonian involved in that has a tunneling parameter, a bias parameter, and a qubit-to-qubit coupling. So the quantum system itself is the adjustable parameters are those values. So that's pretty standard. We looked at this and saw that there's an isomorphism to this kind of processing and the classical neural network in the sense that if you start the quantum system out at time zero at an input state, that's your inputs to the system, then the Hamiltonian processes that, excuse me, and gives you at some time t later an output from the system. In the same way that a neural network takes inputs, processes it via activation function and weights, and gives an output phi. So there's an isomorphism between what the quantum system is doing in its processing and the neural net. So the thought is, well, we can train the Hamiltonian of the quantum system as weights of a neural net with the same kind of machine learning rules. Yeah.
So I have asked this question before, but so where's the non-linearity? I mean, the power of neural networks as a universal function approximators lies in the non-linearity. Obviously, your analogy is just a linear transformation.
Right, so the quantum system, and I'll show you in the quantum lattice gas, there's a non-linearity in there that looks promising. We'll wait till that point, and then I'll show you where we get the nonlinearity in there. Is that what you were asking? Yeah. Okay. For all of this, the input state vector is our density matrix, or the quantum state at time zero, and then we make some measure on the output at the final time, and that's the output of our calculation. So it is a computer. We put an input in. That's some data that we want to calculate, and we get an output. And then the weights, in quotes, of the network are those adjustable parameters, which are the tunneling, the bias, and the qubit-to-qubit coupling. Again, we use supervised learning using target outputs paired with specified inputs. And once trained, the parameters then can be tested on various input and output pairs. So the two-qubit system that we started with to do the entanglement witness, it's two qubits with tunneling, bias, and coupling, and we gave it four different training pairs. In other words, the system starts out in the Bell state, and our target is that should be fully entangled, so we get a one out with our output measure. And then the flat state, we get a zero. The P state, we targeted that to be 0.44. And there's a story behind that that's too long to go through, but the system actually wanted to learn to that value, and that's where we came up with that. And then the C state has the entanglement of zero. So four training pairs for the learning. And after training, we get the tunneling parameter is the upper left corner. The coupling parameter is the right. And then the bias, let me double check, make sure I've got this right. Sorry. Yes, the bias is the lower left, and then the coupling is the upper right. And then the RMS error is on the lower right. So it does train on those four training pairs. And this is with noise introduced into the magnitude of the density matrix to show that we do get learning despite the fact that we've got some noise introduced into the system. The red lines are Fourier fits, we looked at this, and it's obvious that there's a frequency in the parameters. And in fact, the most important parameter here is the coupling parameter between the two qubits on the upper right. And so we got good learning on that, and we also get good testing. And the key here is that it is robust to noise. And then we introduced phase noise decoherence into the parameters, into the density matrix as well. And again, we get, in fact, it's more robust to phase noise than it is to magnitude noise in the system. So it's able to learn the entanglement witness very well. And then we were able to extend this to 3, 4, 5, and 6 qubit systems, where we extended the idea of entanglement to include those qubits, yeah. There is no picture of a network and connectivity. We simply have two qubits. In the two qubit system, we have two qubits. And so the qubit to qubit coupling is the interconnection. Does that make sense? Okay. Of course, as you go up from 3 to 4 to 5 and 6 qubits, the problem grows. And we have more coupling parameters, more bias parameters, and we were able to train this. Now the simulation time becomes large, and so what we were actually able to do is bootstrap. We would use the 2-qubit parameters that worked correctly, and then we would apply the coupling between all 3 qubits and train from there. So we were, in a sense, able to bootstrap from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 and 6 qubits. And the interesting thing was that the more qubits you have, the less the noise made an impact on the system. And it makes sense because the noise was randomly introduced, and so the noise tends to cancel itself out with the training. So that's a quick overview of some of the machine learning that we applied to an entanglement witness. So now I'm jumping to our approach to take the D-wave system and apply machine learning to that, rather than asking it to anneal to a solution of a Hamiltonian that's specified. We want to find the Hamiltonian that will give us the final state, the annealed state that we're looking for. So it's kind of flipping the way the system works around. So the model here, again, we use the density matrix formulation. And again, the idea is that we start our system out at some initial state. For the D-wave system, it starts out in a flat state. And then the Hamiltonian will control that system so that at the final time, we get a target density matrix that the system is annealed to. There's some extra formulation here that actually wasn't used in the simulation that I'm going to show you. That also allows you to control the temperature via the inverse temperature beta term, but that's not relevant to what I'm going to show now. The way we apply machine learning is the standard Lagrangian variational calculus method. And this is very similar to a formulation of backpropagation for neural nets that was done a long time ago by Yann LeCun, where he formulated a cost function in terms of the error of the system, and then also constrain the system to behave according to the dynamics of the system. So what you see there at the top, the left-hand term is the difference between the target density matrix, where we want it to be at the final time, and what the system actually gives at the final time. And then the right-hand side constrains the system to behave according to the Schrodinger equation. The way that the problem is solved is this is optimized with variational calculus to minimize L with respect to the weights, which are actually the parameters in the Hamiltonian. So in this system, we minimize our error with respect to the coupling and the tunneling and the bias term. And we use any minimization method can be used. In fact, we're applying more advanced methods, but gradient descent is the easiest one, so that's what we used. The interesting thing about the way this works is that, so the quantum system starts out at time 0, moves forward to the final time. there an error is calculated between what we wanted and what we got. And in fact, that error then, according to the equation at the bottom, is backpropagated backward in time through the system in order to update the parameters. And this is done via the training pairs. Each training pair is presented. We get an output, we calculate the error, backpropagate it back through, update the weights slightly, and continue that until we converge to the parameters that give us the right answers. So this is the process. We initialize to the flat state just like the D-wave system does. The tunneling function is linearly decreased to zero, which moves the D-wave system from the initial Hamiltonian to the problem Hamiltonian. And then we learn the coupling parameters to give us the final state that we want. So here's our learning pair. We only have one learning pair for the system. That is, we start out in the flat state for 2 qubits, and then we want it to anneal to the density matrix on the right, which is the GHC state. And here's the results. Comparing the actual output after learning to the target, and we've gotten really close. So this says that we, with the parameters, that there's the RMS error. With that coupling, sorry, that's the density matrix as it evolves in time from the initial state to the final state during the annealing process. And then this is the tunneling parameter. Sorry, that's the tunneling parameter. The other one is the coupling parameter. So with that coupling parameter and the standard annealing schedule of the D wave, it looks like we can anneal to an entangled state. We've done bootstrapping on this from 2 to 3 to 4 qubits. Again, we use the parameters that we learned for 2 qubits and simply copy them to the multiple qubits. And we've been able to anneal to multiple qubits. And so this is the results of that. So that's going to 3 qubits. Again, the RMS error on the left, the coupling parameter in the middle, and then the density matrix on the right. And then we go to 4 qubits, 5 qubits, 6 qubits. And if you look down the middle, the RMS error looks really good. The density matrix goes to where it is. But you look down the middle, and the qubit-to-qubit couplings, if we can actually implement those on the machine, would give us the results we expect. Unfortunately, the current technology of the D-wave system limits the changes in the parameters to monotonic, decreasing and increasing parameters. In other words, the way that the D-wave system anneals, follows a very specific annealing path. The solution to that was to create, in other words, to restrict the solution space of the learning to only have the tunneling parameter follow a specific trajectory and then have the coupling parameter follow a monotonically increasing path as well. And in conversations with D-Wave, by the way, I thank them for their input, the systems that they have, they're moving toward being able to do this. That is, pause the annealing and then adjust the parameters and continue on. Pause, and they can control the rate at which the annealing occurs. Still issues, the measurements that can be made on the annealing, quantum annealing machine, the D-wave machine, you can't go in and actually measure the density matrix at different axes at the end. You're limited to just measuring the average spin. So another problem to overcome. And so what we're looking at currently is to construct what we call a broken pathway to that final state. That is, show that we can train to some intermediate states that can be measured, with the hope that we can go further than and demonstrate that at least we're getting part of the way to the final state that we're asking for. So I'm going to flip through some of these. I'm short on time, and I want to show you some stuff at the end. One of the pathways that we've said, we can go from the flat state through an intermediate state that we call the P state that is controlled by gamma, and then to the Bell state. And in fact, we can measure the fact that we've actually ended up in the P state at the final, at the end of the annealing process. And these are some graphs that show, there's too much information to go through right here, but it shows that you can go from flat to P and then from P to Bell. So there is some hope of being able to measure that we could do this. We can also go three qubits, flat to an intermediate state shown there, and then to a GHZ state. And this shows more promise for being able to be extended to more than just three or four qubits. And there's some results that I won't go through. We can go, in addition, we've been able to go not just to the GAC state, but through an intermediate state to the W state. So based on simulations, again, we haven't done this in hardware, but based on simulations, it looks like we might be able to make the D-Wave system anneal to different states at the final state. Again, noise and decoherence are an issue, and so we've introduced noise and decoherence. Of course, the more noise that you get on the x-axis, the more RMS error you get in learning, but it still does learn and it still does reproduce the results at the end. So that's what we've been doing with quantum annealing. And then something that we looked at a while ago that I think is worth mentioning is a spatial quantum lattice gas network. The quantum lattice gas behaves as a nonlinear quantum fluid, according to the equation there in the middle. And it operates in the up-down basis, or the 0-1 basis. But what's interesting is that not only does it propagate quantum information forward in time, but it also happens spatially. And so this looks more like a neural net where the information processes from an input field to an output field through some connectivity. And the most important thing here is that there's a nonlinear term, that phi squared term introduces nonlinearity in the propagation that looks like it's missing in some of the standard quantum Schrodinger equations. Well, I don't have the equation on here. The phi is calculated based on the product of the ket with itself. I don't have the equation here, but there's a nonlinearity there that's part of the quantum lattice gas. And I apologize, I should have put that on here.
I'm wondering if it's kind of similar to Bospitaevsky or not. I guess that's
right. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Is it similar to the Bospitaevsky equation?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah. And so the idea here is that, again, there's the tunneling parameter K. G is a parameter that controls that nonlinearity, so we can train that. And A is another term. And essentially, there's a nonlinear bias term here that can be used. So our hope was to be able to take this and apply machine learning to this. It's interesting in the standpoint of that the back propagation that's done in the machine learning is not only done backward in time, but it's also done spatially through the network, and I'll show you how that happens. Same approach to formulating the machine learning. There's an error that's calculated over an output region that compares the target to the actual output, and then there's a constraint term with Lagrange multipliers that constrains that equation to hold. So this simulates the system and formulates a cost function that we minimize in order to find the trainable parameters. The way we set this up was that the regions in the blue plot on the right, we're doing something simple. It's a two input, one output logic gate. And so those posts there are the probability density function that represents the input of 0 or 1 in that region. Yeah, okay, I'm close to done, so thanks. So the inputs are put in that region and then propagate according to the quantum lattice gas equation over to an output region where we do an output measure on the state of the quantum system in that region. And so that's our mapping, our input to output mapping. And then we have a target value over there in the output region. Interestingly, there are essentially probability waves that propagate through this system. This is a plot of the wave at the final time when we're doing the measurement on the output. And so the inputs have been put in, and then the waves propagate across nonlinear in a nonlinear fashion, and then we measure an output there. The downside to this is we haven't been able to get very good training out of this. And the reason for that is to simulate this. We simply are using a two-dimensional grid. We're having to do a finite difference or a finite element simulation in space and time. And so the computational costs are rather high. In fact, it takes hours to run this simulation in MATLAB. We need to move it forward to see. And in fact, to get, we need to go to a 3D grid to get the soliton behavior as well. So there's more work to be done, moving it to a cluster machine. But it's interesting in the sense that this maps, I guess, in my mind, more to a neural network type behavior where you have the inputs and outputs mapping spatially and temporally. And so that wraps up what I wanted to show you are different ways of trying to apply machine learning to quantum systems to create a quantum computer that we can program. So, questions?
For the first part of the talk, so the quantum neural network, can you comment on the scalability of the training? The training is just a classical, like Bepop-like Lagrangian equation that already look quite complicated for a small case. So is that scalable? So can you solve that realistically bigger systems?
Mathematically, it easily scales up. Computationally, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
But
so you face the same problems as classical neural network training, or even harsher ones?
With regard, what problems are you talking about?
I'm just thinking of neural networks don't consist of two like nodes, but like obviously like hundreds and whatever. And if you want to like apply that training rule or even formulate it, is that difficult?
Honestly, we haven't gotten that far. We've gone as far as 4 or 5 qubits and. I don't know, it's something we need to explore.
Hi. How do you measure the off-diagonal elements of the density matrix on the D-Wave machine?
How do you, you can't.
But it looked like you put up results that indicated.
Oh, it's in simulation.
Okay.
Yeah, we haven't done this in hardware. So, yeah, there's many issues in going to the hardware.
Okay, I think we should thank Jim again and move on to the next talk. Thank you.